Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is saxophone player and Blues Hall of Fame inductee, Joe Sublett. But first of all, Apple Music is adding videos. Yes, they're adding both music videos and long-form videos. Not only that, you're going to be able to access it both on iOS and Android. And right off the bat, there's going to be exclusives from A Tribe Called Quest and Beck, Kylie Minogue, and quite a few others. So video is now going to be a part of Apple Music. This isn't the first streaming network that's trying this. Spotify tried music videos for a little bit and it didn't work out and they dropped it. And back a few years ago, Tidal also tried to do this and it wasn't necessarily a big seller for them. That being said, Apple Music has a lot more clout, and of course Apple is already creating its own content for Apple TV, so a lot of that will be available on Apple Music as well. So there'll be a lot more going on. That being said, there's a reason behind all of this. YouTube is faltering a little bit, and of course what's going to happen pretty soon is they're going to come out with their own new service that's going to take the place of YouTube Red, which again was another failed idea, trying to take the existing users of YouTube and turning into paying users, but no one really went for it. Now what YouTube is going to be doing, and they've been quite open about this, is they're going to add more ads in order to frustrate people so they'll buy into the subscription service, which I don't think is going to work very well. So as a result, Apple Music sees an opening and they're going for it. Not only that, Vevo, which is the video service that's owned by a couple of the major labels, has an exclusive contract with YouTube, but guess what? That contract is up soon. So all of a sudden we're seeing Apple Music get very active in the music video realm. And that should make for a pretty interesting 2018 to see what's going to happen in the music video area. And of course, we're already seeing more of that with Facebook as Facebook also finishes up its deals with the major labels as well. And this has a big part to do with it. Music videos are going to be everywhere pretty soon, so you won't necessarily have to go to YouTube to find them. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Check out my Hitmakers Club for access to the Private Mixers Facebook group, monthly deconstructed hits, mixing workshop and Q&A webinars, and for a short time, access to my core training module bonus. Go to hitmakersclub.com to learn more. Now, you've heard all about Gibson's struggles, and if you listen to this podcast, you've heard me talk about it quite a lot. And if you read my blog, you also have seen quite a lot there. On the other hand, we have Gibson's big competitor, Fender, which is doing quite nicely. Fender is actually growing at a faster pace than the industry, and they're doing really well with younger audiences. And if you read anything from Henry Juskowitz talking about what's wrong with the guitar business, he's always talking about not being able to get younger people involved in playing guitar and buying guitars. Well, maybe Gibson can't, but Fender seems to be doing very well at it. They're developing a younger audience. And they've also come out with the lower cost line of guitars aimed specifically at that younger audience and also at women who are 50% of new buyers of Fender guitars. There's been a number of interesting things that have come to light about how Fender is doing business. First of all, they're selling a lot more guitars online. A few years ago, veteran guitar players would have cringed, and they probably still do now, at the thought of buying a guitar online without actually playing it. And I think if we're going to spend money on a high dollar item, you're going to spend several thousand dollars, you want to touch and feel it before you actually buy it. And we all know, if you've been playing for a while, you know that the feel is different. You can go through 10 different guitars, it'll be exactly the same, and yet one will kind of jump out at you. That being said, if you're buying an entry-level guitar or something that's relatively common, it's a little bit easier to buy a guitar online and feel good about it because the manufacturing processes are so much better these days that the guitars just coming out of the factory are better than they have been probably forever. So more and more guitars are bought online. About 50% of those are by women, And one of the reasons why more and more women are buying guitars online is because they feel intimidated going into a guitar store. So they turn to buying online. Now, this is an opinion. This is something that's coming from Fender. Fender did a big study on who buys their guitars and why. So I'm just giving you the info here. Also found out that 45 of all guitars that are bought, Fender guitars that are bought, are bought by first-time players, but 90% of those will abandon playing within a year. Now, the other 10% are going to be guitar players for the rest of their lives. They're going to keep on buying guitars, and we all know it's hard to buy just one. The other thing that's interesting is new buyers spend four times as much on lessons, and that's why Fender's actually doing so well, because Fender has what they call Fender Play, which is online lessons, and this is aimed at a younger audience, and of course, this is developing new business for this company where it's not happening with Gibson. Now, of course, Gibson's problems are its own making. It's not so much the industry, although you'll have Gibson execs that will be blaming dealers and former dealers and just about anything you can think of, but Fender is proving them wrong because they're doing pretty well. Now, we know that Gibson may, in fact, file for bankruptcy by August because there's a whole bunch of loans and bonds that are due then that they don't think they'll be able to restructure by that time. So, in that case, it'll probably go bankrupt. There is one company that's going to be helped out from all this, and that's Guitar Center, because Guitar Center is one of Gibson's biggest creditors. And of course, if everything's being restructured by Gibson, it gives GC some breathing room. So in fact, that may help them out in the long run. So we have a very interesting dynamic that's happening in the guitar business right now. Fender seems to be doing better than the industry average. And of course, Gibson is just kind of struggling along. So you kind of figure it out from there where the problem is. My guest this week is saxophonist Joe Sublette, who's both a Grammy and WC Handy Award winner, as well as an inductee in the Blues Hall of Fame. His credits include work with superstars like the Rolling Stones, Eric Clapton, Bonnie Raitt, Little Feat, The Band, Stevie Ray Vaughan and Double Trouble, B.B. King, and a host of others. I spoke with him via phone from his home in Los Angeles. All right, so you have a great background, a storied history, but what I want to know is, how did you get started in this business? Let's go back. You're from Florida, right?
No. I was born in Florida, actually, but I grew up in Texas.
Oh, okay. So that explains the Texas influence and everything.
Oh, yeah. I was living in Corpus Christi. I grew up in Corpus Christi, and I guess I would have to say that, you know, I started playing in bands, you know, with my buddies when, you know, practically, you know, right before I got out of high school, and that's really how I got into it, just playing in bands, you know. I love music, you know, and that kind of got me started. You know, me and some of my close buddies were just pretty quickly became like blues fanatics. You know, at the very first it was R&B, and then it was blues. And so that kind of got us going, you know, originally.
How did you get to Austin?
Well, you know, we've been playing, you know, I was thinking about this the other day, you know, me and several of my buddies had these blues bands together. And at the same time, in Austin that we were doing that, there was a scene going on there almost, you know, independent of each other. Not everybody wanted to play blues back then, but Jimmy and Stevie Vaughan were both playing in various bands around Austin. And, I had this band with my friend Sid Sanchez, who I first started playing with, and we had a band, and we were playing six nights a week at this joint. We were just going crazy. We wanted to get out of there. And so I knew about the group called the Nightcrawlers. And I'd actually seen Stevie Vaughan play with various bands. I'd actually gone to Austin on a trip, and I think we were looking for speaker cabinets. And we went and saw Stevie play with the Nightcrawlers. And so I'd met him and knew him a little bit. And so when we were doing this six-night-a-week gig, we said, well, let's see if the Nightcrawlers will come in and spell us for a week, you know? Mm-hmm. And they said, yeah, we'll come in there. And it was Stevie Ray Vaughan, you know.
Yeah.
I never called him Stevie Ray Vaughan ever, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, he's my buddy. And he was a bass player named Keith Ferguson, who later on ended up playing with the Fabulous Thunderbirds, and then Doyle Bramhall. And Doyle Bramhall's got a son now, Doyle Jr., who's played with Eric Clapton, and he produces records and stuff.
Yeah.
And all that. But this was Doyle Sr., and he played drums. And so they came in, and I remember when they first came in, they came over to our band house, and we had a big jam. You know, it was probably the loudest thing you ever heard. But we had a lot of fun doing that. And then, ironically enough, we wanted to get out of that club for a week, just get away from it, and we ended up being in the club every night that the Nightcrawlers played. So we didn't end up really getting out of there for a week. We ended up being down there every night, hearing them play. They were really great, you know, great blues rock band. And so that kind of being aware of Austin, and that there were a handful of guys, you know, not a lot of people were really wanting to play blues. I mean, people now have sort of a view of it that, oh yeah, everybody was into this stuff. No, really, a lot of people weren't. You know, we were playing blues whether people wanted to hear it or not. You know, we just loved it. And so finally, after a few years, I said, well, I got to go to Austin. So we moved there, and our band, and pretty quickly I hooked up with Paul Ray and the Cobras, and that was a band that Stevie Ray Vaughan was playing in at the time. And so that got me into the whole Austin blues scene, playing with the Cobras, playing with Stevie. There was another great guitar player named Denny Freeman, who's still out there playing. He played with Bob Dylan for about 5 years, and most recently. And so, you know, I was instantly in that scene, you know, playing saxophone. And one of the other things that we did besides playing with Paul Ray and the Cobras was there was a club called Antones that had just opened up. And so we backed up everybody. We backed up Buddy Guy, and I played with John Lee Hooker, and we played with Albert Collins, and on and on and on. So to me, that was kind of like blues college, you know?
Sure.
Blues college for me. And so I continued in that scene, and then Stevie left and had several groups that he put together before he finally got Double Trouble together. He had asked me to leave the band, to leave the Cobras, and I kind of didn't really want to leave the band at the time. But I continued to play with him when I wasn't playing with the Cobras on my nights off. And so later on, when he got a record deal, he asked me to play on his records. I think I ended up playing on his third and his fifth record, I think it was. And so I had, you know, Stevie was my roommate. I mean, Chris Layton, who was my roommate, Stevie had said, hey, can you recommend a drummer? I need a drummer. And I said, well, give my roommate a tryout. And so he gave Chris Layton a tryout, and Chris ended up being in Double Trouble until Stevie passed away.
Yeah.
But Stevie, a whole lot of the time, didn't have a place to live. So he was kind of our third roommate, you know, whenever he didn't have a place to stay. So yeah, I continued working with Stevie until he passed away. You know, I think I just worked on In Step, and that record had come out, and less than a year later, he was gone.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So that's the old Austin thing. I mean, it's probably a lot deeper than that. There's a whole lot of other things that were going on at the time, but that really, what I was doing with Paul Ray and the Cobras, and then with Stevie and a lot of the blues people, it's kind of like sort of, I don't know, sort of define who I was as a player.
You started in blues pretty much right away, and as you say,
it
wasn't kind of in fashion at the time.
No.
So what were you listening to in order to get you into the blues?
That's actually a really good question, because, you know, being a teenager, you know, or even younger, we were listening, you know, like everybody else, we were listening to the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, and then Cream came along, and then Jimi Hendrix, and on and on. And one of the things me and my buddy Sid, I was telling you about, that we would sit around and listen to music together, we started noticing who were these guys covering when they were covering, including the Beatles. You know, it was Chuck Berry, and then you start finding Cream and all these different guys were doing blues songs, and so we would start investigating who these covers were by, you know, and who was B.B. King. And this is before B.B. King had hit, you know, with Thrill Is Gone. And so we started digging and finding who are these guys' influences. And so we were listening to blues and R&B guys that these guys were listening to. And, you know, we found out pretty quickly after Cream came along that Eric Clapton had been with John Mayall and the Blues Breakers. And so we started like really listening to the influences of these guys. I ended up, ironically enough, I ended up working with John Mayall and the Blues Brothers on, I don't know, 5 or 6 records, you know, many, many years later. But at the time we were just going, well, who are all these guys? And Rolling Stones were covering blues songs. And so we started getting our head into that. And the other thing about it was in Texas in the 60s and early 70s, Jimmy Reed was on the radio. You know,
yeah.
Slim Harpo was on the radio. And they were being played on Top 40 records. Scratch My Back, which was later on covered by the Fabulous Thunderbirds, that was a hit for Slim Harpo on the radio. Jimmy Reed, which was kind of blues mixed with early rock and roll R&B, was on the radio. So even if we didn't kind of realize that we were already listening to blues and R&B on the radio, we just didn't know what to call it, you know?
Yeah.
And so we already had kind of moved that direction, and then right at the end of high school, Joe Cocker, Mad Dogs and Englishmen, Delaney and Bonnie, Leon Russell, these guys came out, and they were doing their version of R&B soul blues, and me being a saxophone player that wasn't really interested in Chicago, I liked the band, but I wasn't interested in being in a band playing Chicago music or Blood, Sweat, and Tears. To me, they were like college-sounding groups, you know, educated sort of cats, you know.
Yeah.
And they're ba-ba-ba-da-ba and all this kind of stuff. And I was kind of going, that's not for me. I mean, I was still like digging in my head on Stax Volt.
Oh, big
Sam
difference.
And Dave,
yeah.
And all that stuff. And so when I heard, you know, Mad Dogs and Englishmen and Delaney and Bonnie with a horn section, I went, okay, that's the stuff. It's R&B / blues, rock and roll, and I dig it. And so we put together a band that was playing that kind of music. The only other band at the time that was playing stuff that had that feel about it was when Rolling Stones were doing Exile on Main Street. And it was, once again, the same horn section, Bobby and Jim, you know, Bobby Keys, Jim Price.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of a common core, you know, when I was putting these band together. It would be a rock and roll band with a saxophone. You know, playing saxophone solos, and so that kind of moved us away from what was happening. I mean, it was pop music because it was on the radio at the time, but they were playing R&B type stuff. And so when we put together our second band, once again, my friend Sid, we said, "Hell, let's do some Rolling Stones, and then the rest is going to be like John Lee Hooker, and it's going to be Elmore James, it's going to be B.B. King, Buddy Guy, Otis Rush, Junior Wells." And so we were a band, really kind of a blues, I guess you'd call it a blues rock band, but we were playing blues songs, you know, young white guys playing blues, and with the occasional Rolling Stones thing. And so we were moving more and more into that direction. And what we were listening to old blues records. We weren't listening to anything that was on the radio anymore. We were just listening in our rooms, you know, sitting there looking at a John Lee Hooker record, you know, reading the cover, and Buddy Guy, okay, and who played on that record. And so we were becoming more and more those kind of guys, and if we weren't listening to that kind of stuff, we were listening to like old jazz records too.
Okay, I get it. Well, let me ask you a question then. So you played in the house band at Antone's, and you just said it was like going to blues college. What did you learn playing behind those real deal blues guys, the originals, that maybe you didn't pick up from the records?
Well, I mean, you're right there with them. And so the feel that you're getting from the cats and the fact that they didn't really, a lot of these guys made these records, but they didn't have really set patterns. They weren't like, you know, when they would do records, it was improvisational. I mean, it was in the sense that it's okay, well, we know the song, we're going to play it how we feel at this moment. And I really kind of got a feel for, it's not where here's the template, here's the song that you learned off the record. Well, you know, Buddy Guy might call out a song and not play it at all like he did on the record. Maybe it was a shuffle and it was a 12 bar, but it was completely, I might play with him 5 nights in a row, and every night it was a new thing. And so I got to realize that, well, there's the blues form, but it's the feeling more than the form. And a lot of blues guys that I knew that were playing blues in bands, they were like really copying the form. This is a 12 bar blues and it's a shuffle. And that was kind of where they ended as far as like creativity. It was kind of like, well, we're going to play the song. They might as well have been playing, you know, Johnny B. Goode again. it was pretty tried and true stuff. And I played Five Nights with John Lee Hooker. I'm 21 years old, and I asked him, I said, "You got any, any kind of advice for me and stuff?" And he said, "Play the motherfucking shit out of the first note before you go to the second note."
I love it.
And I was going, "What?" And I thought about it, and he was telling me, if you can only play two notes, play them with maximum intensity, maximum soul, right?
Yeah.
In his own way. I mean, he was not an educated guy, but he was a really smart guy. And he was saying, he was telling me it's good to keep it simple.
Yeah.
You don't have to play a bunch of notes to be somebody. And I really took that to heart. From that point on, I went, you know what? It's what you say, how you say it. It doesn't have to be really verbose. It doesn't have to be really notey. And that was one that stayed with me. And, that was good advice. And another one, a guy that I played with, I can't remember which one it was. He had said to me, I had to ask him the same thing. And he said, here's the thing you need to learn. I said, "What?" He said, "Every time I'm hired, I'm fired." And I went, "What? What are you talking about?" He goes, "Well, I might be doing that gig tonight, and I might have one tomorrow night, but every time I'm finished with the gig, I'm fired until I'm hired the next night." And he was kind of trying to tell me that if you're going to be a musician, you got to get used to having times when you don't work and just kind of be able to accept that, And that was another great one, because I thought about it. I think about it all the time. It's like maybe I'm working several weeks in a row and I'm making good money, and then I've got some time where I'm not working. I go, "Well, every time I'm hired, I'm fired, Maybe I better save my money and not spend it on the weeks that I'm not working, And a lot of these guys had stuff like that, I don't know. Well, I just being around these guys, just seeing how they behave, and in spite of the fact of how hard their lives had been, kind of with a lot of these guys, the grace that they went ahead and showed, in spite of the fact that they're prejudiced and the things that they had to deal with, it was pretty amazing,
Yeah, I know what you mean. And it's funny you should mention about the feel as opposed to the form. A few years ago, I went to the Blues Awards in Memphis.
Right.
I had a record that I produced that I think was nominated for something. So the artist asked me to go down. And there were blues bands all day long and all night long. And the surprising thing is they all sounded the same. It was all the same 12 bars for the most part. And every now and then there'd be one that would jump out and would be really special. And you go, "Man, that's it. Okay, that's really it." And it was just what you said. Most of them were just following the form and not the feel.
Yeah, and they didn't learn that here's the vocabulary. Here's the language that you speak, but go ahead and have your own conversation. I also went down back when it was called the WC Handy Awards with Taj Mahal and my band, the Phantom Blues Band. We toured many years and recorded with Taj on a lot of records. But one year we had done our own record with Taj and the Phantom Blues Band, and it won. We won Band of the Year that year. So I remember watching a lot of bands playing there, but there was a band that the house band, and it was Levon Helm playing drums, and Duke Robillard and Bob Margolin, who played with Muddy Waters. It was a group they put together of guys, and that was a group that each one of those guys was aware of the concept that, yeah, we speak a language now. They're through four or five or six of us together, and we're just going to have a conversation. And it was great, and compared to a lot of the other bands that I had seen play, which is exactly an exact reading maybe of something they learned off a record, these guys just played the music. And I remember when I first worked with Taj Mahal, we had gone in to do the first record with him we had done called Dance in the Blues. It was back in 92 or 93 or something. And after a little bit of playing that day, he said, "I love you guys because..." He said, "You'd speak the language." And I hadn't really thought about the concept of that. He said, "We speak a common language, but we have a common vocabulary." And he said, "When we get in a room, we have a conversation. We have a dialogue," or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And he said, "That's how you play music." And he said, "A lot of guys I've got to come in and play on my records, they know the they know the form and they know the beats, and they plug in sort of the generic stuff. And he said, if we all know the same language, then we should be able to go have a conversation. And he said, that's when you're really playing music. And that was really eye-opening to me when he said that, because I knew that, but I didn't. He put it in such a way that I hadn't heard it before like that, is that we all have these common licks and ideas and stuff that we've learned, and that's our language. We're supposed to have a conversation. You don't have the same conversation that these guys had 20, 30, 40 years ago. They were having a unique conversation the day they made that record. But maybe the next time they played it, when they played it live, is a completely different story. And so I think that's the difference between guys that you really love to hear play, and then you kind of go, wow, they all play really well, but they don't move me.
Yeah, right, exactly. Well, okay, you played at the Rolling Stones, right?
Yep.
Now, the Stones started out as a blues band, and I remember hearing them live, and they played Little Red Rooster, and it was awesome. It knocked me out. It was like, okay, that's what these guys are. They're a blues band. What was it like playing with the Stones in terms of just coming from the blues?
Well, it's really interesting because I've been working on a B.B. King record, and we had done a bunch of things with him, and he was doing duets with various artists. And one night, the producer that was producing the record, John Porter, he says, "Hey, can you make it over to Ocean Way? We're gonna go over there with B.B. and we're gonna record it with the Stones." And so, sure. And so I went in. So I come in with B.B. So. I mean, right off the bat, you know, when you come to a Rolling Stones session and you're with B.B. King, you're kind of okay automatically.
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean? Right. And so we were going to be doing an old B.B. King song called Paying the Cost to Be the Boss.
Sure.
A record that was out probably in the 50s. And so we go in, everybody meets, and we're all sitting around. We're going to record this song live with B.B. in the room with the Stones and with me and Daryl Leonard, my partner in the Texas Kelly Horns. And we were going to be recording this live in a room. And so I was going, well, that's cool, because lots of times I would just get called and, you know, add the stuff later, and I would never even see the guys. And so I'm going, this is cool. And so basically somebody got out a cassette player or put on a tape of the original Paying the Cost to Be the Boss. And we all cuddled around it. The whole band sat around and listened to it for like about 3 or 4 minutes. Everybody kind of listened, me and the other horn player kind of just quickly copying what the original guys did, but not really enough to really get an idea of exactly what the arrangement was, but just enough to get a riff in our head, you know. Mm-hmm. And you know that because of working with you, you know, it's just we get a riff together and we go, let's see if this works. And so we everybody got their part, and basically we listened to it for a few minutes. Everybody walked in the room, sat down on their instruments, and we played the song maybe once or twice. And so I was getting a real idea of what it was like playing with those guys when they were playing blues and weren't trying to make a Rolling Stones record. And so I think I sort of was serendipitous in a way that I got to see those guys kind of like I originally loved them as a blues band, like you did.
Yeah.
And because they're in a room playing a shuffle, a B.B. King song, and B.B. sitting there on a stool, you know, about 4 feet away from me, Mick Jagger's right in front of the horn section, and he's telling the engineer who said, maybe we need to baffle you off so the horns won't go into your vocal microphone. He's going, oh, no, no. He said, that's the way those old records were made. Everything bleeding into each other. I went, I liked you before, now I like you a lot more.
Yeah,
you
know? Right.
He said, I don't care if the horns are coming into my microphone. That's what's going to make the stuff sound like the real stuff. And I was going, wow, okay. And so, you know, we played a few songs, and that's the way it went down. So I got a feeling for what those guys are like when they're not up there doing, you know, Satisfaction or Jumpin' Jack Flash. They're playing a blues song with B.B. King and with a horn section. Everybody in the room cutting live, no overdubs, one or two takes. And so I really got a great feel for what it must have been like for them more in the original days. Now, I went 2 weeks later, was called back in, and we did Bridges to Babylon. So we did their record as well. And that was a whole different thing. I mean, you know, they're building the tracks and they're adding horns. I mean, they're there when we're putting the horns down. Those guys are very hands-on. Keith and Mick were there when we were doing all our overdubs, you know, with, you know, guidance. Well, try this, or could you do this? And so they're very hands-on. Don was producing, but, you know, those guys are, you know, they have to sign off on what's going down.
Yeah, sure.
And so that was a more traditional experience working with the Rolling Stones. And if I'd had that experience, I would have loved it anyway. But like I say, the 2 weeks before a recording with them with B.B. King really kind of gave me a feeling for what it was, kind of what they were really like when they first started out, just playing a song.
Sure, sure. Well, speaking of the blues then, and modern blues especially, Clapton. So what period did you play with Clapton?
Well, I played with Clapton on two different occasions, actually if including a lifetime, three different occasions, back in 95 when we were recording Phantom Blues. Clapton came in just to record with us. So he had said, yeah, you'd love to come in. And so he was in the room. We were recording live with also the stuff that we did with Taj Mahal was always everybody in the room, horns, everybody. Learn the song quickly and then do a reading of it. Just one or two, three takes, whatever. And so, you know, my first time of ever being around Eric Clapton, I'm sitting in the little horn booth and he's sitting in a chair about 4 feet away. I'd never even seen him play live after all the years of loving him as, you know, and loving his music stuff. I'd never even gone to see him live. And so my first time I've ever seeing him or hearing him was when I'm in the studio playing with him. So that was, you know, it's kind of like, well, I got to see him finally. Oh, here he is. You know, so he's sitting in a chair. We're all sitting around in the studio, and he's playing live solos. And it was funny because when I first got to the studio, it was Sound City, and I'm sure you know that.
Yeah,
studio.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure you've been there many times and worked there.
Yep.
He was there before the rest of the guys had got there, and he had a little, once again, a cassette player that was sitting on top of the piano, and he's listening to the parts that he's going to play on a Freddie King song, Lover with a Feeling, and then another song that we did, Here in the Dark, by T-Bone Walker. And so he was sitting there with his guitar listening to his bits that he was going to be playing on the song when we recorded these two songs. So he was already there before us to kind of doing like a little homework. And I thought, well, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah.
He's like very intently, very, very intently, very focused, you know, listening to, and he's playing along with it. And kind of, you know, he's getting his way of approaching it. And it sounded very Eric Clapton, but he was playing more or less what he was hearing in his own way. And like I say, it was both times, the Freddie King and the T-Bone Walker, he was pretty much nailing this stuff. And I'm sure these weren't songs that he had never played. And plus, that's what he plays, you know?
Yeah.
That's who you learn from, you know?
Yeah.
So that was fun. And the next time I worked with him was, I came in and did an overdub, me and a section. It was some of the Tower Power guys and me and another guy named Nick Land on trombone and Doc Kupka on baritone. And we went and put horns on this record that he calls, it was about two or three records ago, and it was called Old Sock. And I was kind of going, that's kind of a weird name for a record. And apparently that's what David Bowie called Clapton. He said, you're comfortable like an old sock.
Oh, I love it.
So that's what he called when he would see Clapton, he'd call him old sock. And this is, you know, this is a few years ago. This is before, you know, we lost David Bowie, but I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah.
I think I call my record old sock.
Yeah, right.
You can get away with that, but Clapton, right?
Yeah, right. Very cool.
Yeah.
So you've also been an actor, right? You've been in a number of films.
Well, I've played music in films, but I really couldn't call myself an actor. I've been a musician in some films, but I really wouldn't. Where exactly did you hear about this particular thing?
Oh, I did my research.
Yeah, I would say that I've only been in films as a musician on screen, and I really couldn't call that really much of an actor.
You're playing yourself.
Yeah, I play myself. You know, we need a band in a scene, you know.
Yeah.
Hey, you know what? I welcome those times when that happens because the SAG-AFTRA, boy, they take care of their members.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's funny being a musician, you know, in this world sometimes, it's hard, you know, and I got just a little glimpse doing a few films as a musician, how SAG-AFTRA kind of takes care of their people, you know. I was kind of like, oh, I'm getting residuals and stuff.
It's always nice, huh?
Yeah, who would have thought that, yeah.
Okay, so you were elected to the Blues Hall of Fame. How cool is that?
Oh, I'm honored, you know. I'm honored, I'm very honored, you know. I mean, so oftentimes playing this kind of music, you know, people don't really get any kind of any kind of recognition, you know?
Yeah, yeah, right. Can you point to one magic session or magic gig that you did that was just off the charts that really sticks out above all the rest?
Well, I think I might have mentioned a few already when I'm talking about working with B.B. King. I mean, we did one before we went in with the Stones. And, of course, I was, you know, early on, I mean, when I heard Thrill Is Gone, I mean, that sort of just sort of tilted me. And that was, 1968, 69 or
yeah,
something?
Yeah, yeah.
I was like 15 or 16 or something, you know. And when I heard that, that just the feeling, once again, you know, we were talking about the feeling and not the form. I mean, that was a blues song that had strings on it. And there's French horns and stuff in the background, but not you know, you as a producer knows sometimes that can be a horrible thing, you know, when you have that stuff. But it was so tastefully done, and it was a minor blues, and it just got me. And so I was a huge fan, and had been listening to BB for a long time before I ever met him. And I met him probably through working with Stevie Ray Vaughan live on some gigs, he only did Antones one time, and that was at the very beginning of Antones' career. I mean, he was really kind of too big to go play Antones in Austin. He was playing big places and stuff. And so when I finally got to meet him, I'd actually been a musician a long time and had really played with a lot of the blues people and stuff. So he was always just an incredible gentleman, always remembered me when I would see him, and he would remember where he had last seen me. And I, you know, you can tell I truly loved the guy. So when I finally got to record with him, we were going to redo Thrill Is Gone. And my partner, Daryl, had written a really good arrangement that kind of approximated the original, and it was Tracy Chapman was going to be doing a duet with him. And we went in the studio and recorded that song live with all the players. There was even a couple of French horn players. There was a guy playing cello, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was an approximation of a version of the song with BB just doing another version of it. And so to be in the studio and recording Thrill Is Gone live, you know, not even have to go in later as an overdub, but being in, you know, I could see him in the... By this time, we'd already done a few cuts with him, but I could see him, you know, right in front of me, probably maybe 10 feet away in the booth, singing and playing live. And we did two takes, and the thing I noticed is that, once again, he was not a form guy. He was a guy that he played the feeling, and it could be 10 different takes, and they would all be wonderful. And he did two takes, and they were completely different. And he comes out of the booth, and he's got tears in his eyes. And I mean, it almost made me want to cry. He was just going, and I was going, well, B, what's wrong, man? He's going, oh, nothing wrong. That's just so great. I just so love that. And I was going, wow. I mean, you know,
yeah.
I mean, what an honor, right? And so we started talking, and I said, B, you said you played two completely different solos, and they were both great. They were just completely different. And he says to me, he goes, well, you know, I can't play the same thing twice. He said, I had to be a leader of my own band. He said, I don't know many chords on the guitar. You know, I'm a soloist and a singer. And he said, the soloing is an extension of my singing. And he said, I always had to have a really good rhythm guitar player in there playing the chords. And he said, so I had to, you know, kind of had that my own band because I wasn't good at learning other people's stuff. And I said, well, thank God for that.
Yeah.
You know? So, I mean, that one stands out. I mean, recording with BB and the Stones was also a really cool thing. There's been some nice ones, you know, that maybe are not really big and famous ones, like working with Percy Sledge. And once again, he teared up because we'd all come together on this record. You know, Steve Cropper was on it and James Gadson and, you know,
wow.
A wealth of great players had come together to do a record with him. And he hadn't had a chance to record in, I don't know, maybe 15, 20 years. And he's in the studio, and we did a record on him, which got nominated for a Blues Award, and I think might have gotten nominated in the Grammy category as well. And he was just so moved that he was getting to do a record again that he had tears in his eyes. So, you know, if you can sort of be somewhat part of moving some of your favorite artists to tears, you know, you think, well, we must be doing our job right, you know, and to all of us, it's just an honor being in these people's presence. You know, we don't think we're doing anything special. We, we just kind of think that they're allowing us and maybe, you know, causing us to be better than we normally would be just to be in their presence. And I do find that to be true. If I'm playing with really incredible artists, they kind of lift you up to their level.
I have one BB story. I used to be friends with the guys that would mix the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. So this is going back a ways. But I would go over in the afternoon and I would visit them. And usually around 3 o'clock is when the guest artist would come in, if it was a band or a musical artist, would come in and do their check. And I happened to be there one day when B.B. King was there. And B.B. tore it up. He tore it up, so much so that he got a standing ovation from the crew after it was finished during a sound check. And you know how jaded these guys are. They've been there. They've heard it all. But everybody, when I'm talking about it, the hairs in the back of my head are standing up because it was like so electric. You were firsthand there to get something like that, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah, yeah. I feel fortunate too. And like you say, electric and inspirational, and even the most, you know, I did the Tonight Show back there when that original, you know, Johnny Carson and that whole crew, I think the first talk show that I ever did after I moved out here was Johnny Carson, you know, and that you're absolutely, right, that crew, the sound guys and the stage guys, they were jaded as you can possibly imagine.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I mean, they just were like phoning it in, and I remember going over to Ed Shaughnessy's drum set, you know, with the Tonight Show Orchestra, and I walked over and looked at the drums, and they were like cigarette butts stuck into like the tom-tom. He's using the tom-tom as an ashtray.
Yeah.
It was the most nasty, like, drum set you've ever seen in your life. And I asked the guy, so what happens? He said, well, he keeps using it as an ashtray until, like, on one of the performances, he hits that tom-tom, and then his stick goes through, and it's time to change his head. that's how jaded those guys were, you know, were. I mean, even the, you know, I mean, they were all happy to be there, of course. You know, it was, you know, what's not to like about a gig like that? You know, you go and you work in the afternoon for a few hours, and you go out and play a nightclub and play jazz or something, you know what I mean?
Yep.
You know? But yeah, they were jaded, and BB, I think, because BB was always playing straight from the heart. Once again, getting back to the 12 bar and the form instead of the feeling, BB King could bring that feeling, that solo ability, on almost any kind of music. You've heard him do it on soundtracks where he's playing, with the Crusaders, or he's playing with, you know, Bono or something. You know, he brought that feeling, that ability to speak with the guitar, he brought that to anything that he played. And so if he was playing with a rock and roll band or a funk band or whatever, he always brought that in because he was speaking from the heart. And so to me, I think that's what I learned from BB, is that it's about the feeling. And, you know, don't have a bunch of preset patterns, and try not to, you know, try to always say something, you know, if you can, that's, if not original, heartfelt, you know.
You know, with me, by the time I saw BB, I think he was sitting in a chair mostly. Or he's pretty stationary. And I remember thinking of him in that way. But then I remember seeing something from the early 60s where he played in a club in New York. And he was standing, and he was so dynamic, and he was animated.
My gosh, yeah.
And he was just commanding in a way that he wasn't in later years, in the same way anyway. But I got a different impression of him because he was shouting, gospel shouting in a way.
Yeah.
It was so cool. I remember, out of all the artists, there was quite a number of all-stars on that. That was the one that really stood out. I was like, wow, that's BB? Wow. That.
Even though he was always a little bit of a rotund kind of guy, he moved and grooved and just took it to the audience. I mean, he did it well into, you know, we did it with Taz. We did a lot of BB King tour stuff, you know. It would be the BB King tour, and there would be, you know, 8 or 10 bands. And our slot was always right before, he loved Taj, and our slot would be the last slot before BB came on. And so we would stick around, and we would just, like, leave the stage, and pretty soon he was on. We were sitting in chairs along the side. I saw, like, I don't know, dozens and dozens of shows, and he was beginning to sit down by this time. But every once, he was still able at this time to get up out of the chair when he was really moved, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'd seen him originally probably for the first time in, you know, 1970 or something, or, you know, a couple years after Thrill Is Gone. And so I got to see him being that young guy. But even through his 40s, 50s, 60s, and even into his 70s, he was dynamic.
Yeah.
And he could really move it, you know. It's great, you know.
Very cool, Joe. Last question. What's the best piece of business advice that you learned, either maybe somebody told you or you learned along the way?
I have that one really easily ready at my fingertips. And I think you will relate to this as a lifelong musician, producer. I was on a session when I first got out here, and I was talking to this saxophone player, and he was on the session. He was a guy that I knew about. He was a big band guy, and he'd been around for a long time, and he had laid down a section on a song, and I came in and played a soprano solo on this one other song, and he was still there when I got there. I said, "You got any advice for me? I'm new to town, and just, you know," I thought he was going to give me some, you know, jazz player, you know, "Here's what you do on this altered chord with the flat five and the raised nine," or, you know, just something along those lines.
Yeah.
And I thought it was what he was going to tell me, and he goes, "Okay, Joe, I got some good advice for you." And I said, "What?" And he said, "Here's the thing." He said, "When your accounts work, you work. And when your accounts don't work, there's nothing you can do, you know, come hell or high water, to get them to work.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Wait, first of all," I said, "what's an account?" And he goes, "You know, the cats that hire you, man. You know, if you're working with a big band, or you're working with this producer, or you're working on this job," he said, "those are your accounts." I said, "Oh, okay. I've never heard that term, you know, coming from Austin, you know."
Yeah.
I said, "You know," and he said, when your accounts work, you work, and when they don't, you don't. So he said, "So when you're working and you're like making a bunch of money," he said, "be putting that money away," he said, "as if you're not making that money, because," he said, "when the times come, when you got a week or a month or a couple months or whatever," he said, "you're going to be real happy you didn't spend it all when you were making it." And he said, "that's one of the most important things a professional musician can know, is to always kind of act like you're, even if you're making big dollars, kind of act like you're making small dollars." And so I don't know if I really took to his advice, you know, as well as I should have. But I always thought about that when things are a little slow, and I would think, "Oh man, that cat told me, man." He said, "You know, save your money, because you're a musician, and you're going to really, when it rains, it really pours, and when it doesn't, it's dry."
Yeah.
And so he was trying to tell me, you know, be smart about your bread, you know. And I think that was great advice. I mean, did I heed it completely? Maybe not.
We never do, do we?
You know, I still think about it, though, to this very day. When there's a slow period, I go, "Oh man, the cat, man. He told me way back when." You know, I thought I was going to get some kind of genius. You know, it was genius, really, what he told me. I thought I was going to kind of get some, like, you know, golden key, you know, saxophone. Here's where you listen to this guy, or you go and find this book. You're going to really be okay. I didn't get any of that from him. Just save your money, dude. That was basically it. And so I think it was good advice. I wish, you know, sometimes I wish I'd been a little bit more, you know, like he said I should be, but, you know, that's where it goes.
Yeah, I understand. Well, this is great. I'm glad we got a chance to talk.
Me too, man.
We have a similar background in a lot of ways. I did a lot of blues.
Yeah, well,
I produced a lot of blues in the early 90s. Joe Houston, the saxophone player, the blues guy.
I love Joe Houston, yeah.
I did a couple of records with him. I actually did a couple of really short tours with him as well, which was very much like your experience at Antone's, where he would turn around, he'd call a song, and he'd call a key, and it wouldn't be the key that he would call, and we weren't sure exactly what the tempo was or anything. He would count He'd count it off at one tempo and then play it at another one. So
I know, I played with him one night. I played, backed him up at the Greek. It was like one of these old rock and roll shows, and he came out, and I think that time that I played with him, it kind of worked out okay. But I'll tell you something. I played with Earl King.
Yeah.
Remember Earl King?
Oh, yeah, yeah,
from
yeah.
New Orleans?
Yeah.
Well, ironically enough, I just worked on this record. It's Reese Winans from Double Trouble. Joe Bonamassa is going to produce a record on his keyboard player, Reese, and Reese was in Double Trouble.
Yes, yes, J.J. Blair.
J.J. Blair, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, he's my buddy. He told me he was doing it. Yeah, he loved it.
So they call me. They call me and say, you know, Chris Layton called me from Nashville. And he said, yeah, I would just talk to Joe Montemasi. He's going to want you to play on it because you played on the original. And it had been 29 years ago that I played on the original Caught in the Crossfire with Chris and Tommy and Stevie and all the guys. And the trumpet player that I was playing with back then was still, I still play with Daryl Leonard. So he said, yeah, they're going to call you. And so I got a call and I went in and was recording Caught in the Crossfire. It was Sam Moore singing, you know, Stevie's no longer with him. And it was Kenny Wayne Shepherd playing guitar. And then, Chris Layton, Tommy Shannon and Reese Wynas. And it's Reese Wynas' record, which Bonamassa is producing.
Yeah.
And so Joe goes, hey man, you know, I said, Joe, so like, he goes, yeah, I know you played on the original. And I said, well, last time I saw you, Joe, was when you were 12 years old. I backed you up out here. And he's going, oh my God, I remember that gig. And he said, the guitar player was playing like a Birdland through like a Tweed Fender. I mean, he remembered everything. And I said, it was you. And I said, it was Earl King. And it was Larry Texas Flood Davis. We said it at the same time. It was funny because he goes, Larry Texas Flood. And he goes, yeah, I remember that gig. And I said, do you remember? You probably don't remember this because you weren't in on it. But I said, we did our set with Earl King, and we had run songs in the afternoon with you, and we ran songs for Larry Davis, and everything was fine. And then we ran songs for Earl King. And when we got out to play with Earl King, he did every song a half step up. And so we started playing the song that we had rehearsed in G or in G sharp or whatever. It's like he had drank cough syrup or something. You know, he was completely fucked up, you know? And he said, wow. He said, yeah, I mean, it's, I don't know if I remember that. And I said, yeah. So I said, experience with you when you were 12 was good. And Larry Davis and then Earl King was like, he's, you know, so it's that Joe Houston thing you're talking about. You know, it's like, you know, you rehearse the songs and then you go out and then they start playing in a different key and everybody's scuffling, you know.
Well, we didn't even rehearse the songs. He would just call them and everybody in the band.
He'd call them in the wrong key.
He would call, no, he'd call a song that nobody knew. And also a song in the wrong key and counted off at a different tempo when we'd all look at each other like, what the hell is going on? So it would be a train wreck for the first 12 bars until we kind of figured it out. And then it would be okay after that. But it was really an adventure.
Oh, man. Well, that's what playing live music is, isn't it? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely. Definitely.
And then lots of times it's good. And sometimes it's like, oh, my God, I just barely got through that.
You can find out more about Joe at joesublett.net. That's not .com, .net, N-E-T. Joe Sublett, JOESUBLETT.net. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@BobbyOInnerCircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to BobbyOsinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to BobbyOInnerCircle.com or find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Google Play. At BobbyOsinski.com and BobbyOInnerCircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.